run web business would fare in the indiscriminating crosshairs of Wall Street. iVillage's stratospheric success was a good sign in some ways. It showed that the market took women's media seriously and was willing to stake big money. But Marlene wasn't certain lightning would strike twice. "It affected me," she admits. I said, "Oh shoot, we better get out there." Women.com Networks, Inc. filed their own S-1 only 2 months later. "You know when the time is right because the investment banks are coming suddenly to visit," Marlene explains. It was the right time. It was probably the only window we could have used. That October, Marlene and Ellen watched their new stock ticker spool across the screens in Times Square. WOMN. Women.com's IPO was nowhere near as splashy as iVillage's, but it was perfectly reasonable. The company's initial $10 offering price per share nearly doubled on the first day of trading and climbed to $23 by the end of the month. On the back of a high-profile advertising campaign that followed, Women.com even nosed past iVillage in the Media Metrics Top 50, prompting iVillage to take out a full-page response in the Wall Street Journal, implying that Women.com had earned its place only by merging with Hearst. "There's a difference between aggregating websites and building the leading brand," read the headline. But despite such antagonism from its primary competitor, industry analysts predicted that Women.com Networks, Inc. would be a key internet player for years to come. Barely more than a year later, everything fell apart. Marlene audibly exhales when I ask about Women.com's fate. "Not my favorite topic," she concedes. "I'd never in my life been in a company where revenue actually declined in a quarter," she says. "I wasn't alone, but I had to report that as a public company. Our stock started sliding, and I could see the handwriting on the wall." She initiated an idea to her board. In order to become unfucked, Women.com needed a merger. "Once you're hurt by the markets, you become one of the living dead," she says. I moved quickly. On February 5th, 2001, Women.com made an unexpected announcement. The network's biggest competitor, iVillage, would acquire Women.com in a complicated stock deal valued at $47 million. While the merger was still pending, iVillage received a notice from NASDAQ saying that their company stock was teeteringly low, on the brink of being delisted, and almost immediately after the merger went through, the newly doubled company fired half its staff. The Wall Street Journal drew an unflinching conclusion. The internet cannot sustain several major ad-dependent sites catering to the niche market of women's interest. Things may not have been so dire. After all, plenty of ad-supported women's sites and apps thrive online today, serving puff content, incisive feminist commentary, and everything in between. The difference between these and the women's sites of the early web is that the latter imagined themselves as portals, one-stop shops, where women could get all the internet they needed. This might have worked in the very beginning, when women were still in the minority online. But as the web grew up, so did its users. After a while, a woman's portal began to seem like a misuse of the medium. Why would a woman interested in finance need to surf Women.com's money pages when she could just go directly to Bloomberg? Who needed fashion tips from iVillage, for that matter, if Vogue had a website? It's not that the market couldn't support more than one website for women. It's that women, once they got online, could take it from there. Chapter 13. The Girl Gamers. Computers have no gender, naturally. But the collective social understanding of who computers are for, who uses them, builds them, or buys them, shifts from generation to generation. In the 19th century, computers were actually women, and in the 1950s, they were a woman's game, until programming was professionalized and masculinized. The ARPANET, built on a technical backbone radiating from military and academic centers, was male-dominant because the people designing that infrastructure came from environments that favored men. Early hypertext was designed by women on the peripheries of computer science, but it took a man to popularize their ideas. Until, finally, in the early years of the web, access to personal computers let women back in, and a generation of female culture workers and entrepreneurs made their impact yet again. In all that time, the technology has always reflected what was put into it and by whom. As the researcher Jane Margolis notes, very early in life, computing is claimed as male territory. This claiming is largely the work of a culture and society that links interest and success with computers to boys and men, leading to the cumulative discouragement of women. What Margolis evocatively calls the bitter fruit of many external influences. This discouragement permeates technical culture at every level. In school computer labs. In the way a home computer might be placed in a young boy's room rather than in a sister's. In a mass market media that lionizes male geeks. And even in computer operating systems themselves, which the sociologist Sherry Turkle points out are so brusque they speak of crashes and executions, and go so far as to ask if we would like to abort ailing programs. It also starts young, with the earliest stirrings of a child's gender socialization. In the mid to late 1990s, while the women of the World Wide Web were fiercely staking their place in a rapidly evolving information ecosystem, another battleground for the hearts and minds of female computer users began to emerge. It wasn't online, and it wasn't in academia either, although it would have an indelible effect on both. Rather, it was a fight to reshape the very first impressions that computers make on girls, and to redirect their passions toward the screen with an activity that justifies access and representation alike. Playing computer games. Combat epistemologist. Brenda Laurel tells two different stories about the first time she saw a computer. In the first one, she's 12. It's Halloween in Ohio, 1962. Describing her costume, an ear of corn, she says dryly, "It was the Andy Warhol period." Her mom built it from a chicken wire frame stuffed with kernels of yellow cotton. Brenda could hardly see out the eye holes, but she was convinced she'd earn first prize in a costume contest held at the local supermarket. By the time she'd waddled over, however, another kid had won. Brenda's mother, a little bitty feisty woman who thought the world was pointed at her like a gun, complained to the man in charge, the manager of a hardware store. As a consolation, he handed Brenda a prize from off the shelf. A little plastic box with the word ENIAC stamped on it. "It's a computer," he said. The toy ENIAC came with a stack of cards, each printed with a question. He took one from the top of the stack. "What is the distance between the Earth and the Moon?" Placed it in the machine, and turned a crank on the side. The answer spat out of the other end. It was printed on the reverse. Brenda didn't catch the trick, and she had no way of knowing that the real ENIAC would have come up with its answer with the help of a group of women programmers. But she marveled at the idea of a machine in relation to the cosmos. "I had an epiphany," she remembered. "For a moment, I was transported out of my chicken wire cage, out of the age of schoolbooks and typewriters, and into a glorious time when computers would answer the really hard questions for us." In the second story, she's older. It's the mid-1970s, and she's getting her PhD in theater at Ohio State, a fitting pursuit for the would-be winner of a costume contest. One of her closest friends, Joe Miller, has a job at a nearby research lab, and one night he brings her in, after hours, to show her the second computer that she ever saw. It was painting, as she describes it, pixels from Mars. Just as she'd imagined about the toy ENIAC of her childhood, this was a machine that spoke to the stars. She fell to her knees. "Whatever this is," she said, "I want a piece of it." Fortunately for Brenda, Joe started a small software company, the kind that existed before the monopolies of Apple and Microsoft. His shop wrote programs for the CyberVision, a primitive home computer system sold exclusively at Montgomery Ward that has been all but forgotten. It plugged into a normal television set. The existing television remote control played double duty as mouse. And its programs came on standard stereo cassettes, or cyber sets, running audio and data on separate channels. As a personal computer, the CyberVision was wildly ahead of its time. It offered a whole suite of programs, home finance software, color games, educational tools, and animated fairy tales for children, all rendered in blocky pixels on 2K of RAM. This last piece was Brenda's first foray into the art of software. She'd done fairy tales in theater, and her wandering production of Robin Hood's Tales, staged at intervals among the oak trees of the Ohio State campus, was a hit with children and adults alike. Despite Brenda's lack of programming knowledge, Joe asked her to come work for him, to design CyberVision's pixel fables. It became her education. Without knowing it was hard, she immersed herself in the world of computers, doing everything from graphic design to programming to making coffee. In those days, code was hand-diagrammed with pencil and paper before being hand-converted into the assembly language understood by the CyberVision's CDP-1802 microprocessor, an integrated chip used in a number of hobbyist and consumer-level microcomputers in the 1970s. As she squeezed Goldilocks and the Three Bears into four-color pixel animations, Brenda showed herself the ropes. Placed prominently in the 1978 Montgomery Ward Spring Catalog, the original CyberVision sold 10,000 units in its first year. Not bad for a computer company from Columbus, Ohio. But the market for personal computers was small and the competition steep. Sears had the Atari systems. Radio Shack was pushing its own Tandy computer, and the golden age of arcade games was well underway. When CyberVision folded in 1979, Brenda still hadn't finished her dissertation. But no matter. She was a game designer now. When she moved out to California to work for Atari, she saw the ocean for the first time. We sit in her garden and talk over iced tea. To Java and pomegranate juice, the house drink. She sucks on an American spirit, sitting unnaturally straight. She's recovering from back surgery, her second, and her shock of curly hair is accented with pops of magenta and aquamarine. As we talk, two muscular cats with Japanese names clamber around the garden, which is really a forest. 5 acres of pristine land near the Portola Redwoods, a senselessly beautiful 2 hours drive from San Francisco. As the sun moves across the picnic bench, it strikes a pile of abalone shells tossed in the sawdust behind her. Brenda and her husband are abalone people. They free dive off the Northern California coast to wrench the opalescent shells from rock faces with a pry bar. The trick, she tells me, is to catch them unaware. Even bivalves lock down when they sense the current of change. It took Brenda 4 years to pull her first abalone. One day, mid-dive, she remembered that she'd been born left-handed. She switched the pry bar from right to left and pried that sucker in one brute pull, ka-chunk. None of these things are metaphors for how Brenda works, but they do add up to something. A woman with stealth and force when it's needed, with a hidden prying arm and a garden full of rainbows, each of them a death. In California, Brenda strategized software for the Atari 400 and 800 computers. Since Atari had originally made its name in the arcade, the company wanted its new personal computers to run its most iconic games, and Brenda spent a lot of her time and energy porting Atari titles over to the computer. It drove her crazy. The way she saw it, the games already ran better on a console that cost a tenth as much. By the time her team made it to Ms. Pac-Man, she went to the president of the computer division and said, "You know what? I can't stand it anymore. Let me show you." She pulled out the whiteboard and listed all the things she thought Atari should be doing in home computers. Personal finance, education, word processors. And the guy said, "Your salary's doubled, and you're reporting to me." These are the kinds of leaps Brenda makes with both feet. When she decided the department's corporate overseers were gunning for her job, she took herself across the street to Atari's research lab. It was headed by Alan Kay, a computer scientist known for his pioneering work on object-oriented programming and for designing the overlapping windows of a computer desktop. Kay took Brenda under his wing, buying her several more years at Atari. In Kay's lab, she designed an artificial intelligence system based on Aristotle's Poetics to generate compelling new scenarios for computer games. From there, she jumped to Activision, where she produced games like Maniac Mansion, and then Apple, where she brought some of her more radical friends, like LSD pioneer Timothy Leary, into dialogue with the Human Computer Interface Group. Somewhere along the line, she finally finished her dissertation, which argued that computer programs are like theater. They both have scripts, and neither perform or are performed the same way twice. Brenda's house is several miles down a one-lane road, through a Madrona wood. There's a labyrinth chalked onto the driveway, and a shelf of classic Star Trek memorabilia in the living room. On her office door, a plaque reads, Brenda Laurel, Ph.D., Combat Epistemologist. And in a low closet underneath the stairs, she keeps baskets of fabric, long spools of maypole ribbon, and plastic flowers, their green wire stems akimbo. We have to pull it all aside to get to the plastic tub in the back, stuffed with memorabilia of a different kind. She's promised me we can go through the archives. Everything in the box is purple. There are toy figurines, vacuum-packed in clamshell plastic. There are sets of trading cards, collections of opalescent beads in purple velvet baggies, and CD-ROMs in purple boxes with names like Rocket's Tricky Decision and Rocket's Adventure Maker, a couple of the titles she produced when she was the head of her own computer game company, Purple Moon. As she's jamming loose ribbon and tulle back into the cupboard, I read the company's mission statement, printed on the back of a disc. Deep friendships, love of nature, the confidence to be cool, the courage to dream. It's what girls are all about. And it's what girls share when they discover Purple Moon Adventures, which is why Purple Moon is just for girls. Purple Moon. In 1992, Brenda got a job at Interval Research, a Palo Alto think tank funded by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. Interval was all R and very little D. Researchers wandered into the weeds, studying technologies that were still far from being commonplace, like telepresence and interactive video. Brenda had just come in from the weeds herself. She'd founded a virtual reality company, Telepresence Research, that had folded within a year. She often calls herself a member of the Crash Test Dummy Club, those breakneck dreamers who try to make things before they're economically feasible. It's an uncomfortable, but fine, wild ride, she says. Painful as the consequences may be for them, crash test dummies always see what's coming up ahead. Brenda noticed something while trying to develop virtual reality. Men and women seemed to experience it differently. When I interviewed men about VR, she tells me, they would typically say it was an out-of-body experience. But when she talked to women, they would typically say they were taking their sensorium into a different environment. It was a nuance, but it was enough to get Brenda thinking about gender and technology and how small imbalances in how technologies are designed have a larger net effect on who uses them, who benefits from them, and who profits. At Interval, she narrowed her focus further, opting to study the generation of children just then coming of age in a personal computer-driven world. Children like her own daughters. During her first 4 years at Interval, Brenda asked a small question with big implications. Why didn't little girls play computer games? Games provide many kids with their first hands-on exposure to computers. But just as Brenda was starting at Interval Research, among fourth through sixth grade students, heavy users of computers were overwhelmingly male. Researchers at that time found that while girls tended to see the computer as a means to accomplishing a task, like word processing, boys were more likely to play games, to program, and to see the computer as a playful, recreational toy. Behavior that breeds familiarity, then mastery. This trend toward socializing computers as the pursuit of male nerds emerged from the long, slow masculinization of software engineering, and it continued to be perpetuated in popular culture, in films like War Games, Revenge of the Nerds, and Weird Science, in which nebbish boys program their dream woman, and from the marketing of computers and computer games throughout the 1980s and 1990s. After interviewing nearly 1,000 children and 500 adults all over the United States over the course of 4 years, Brenda came to believe that the problem wasn't about access, or even really the representation of computers in media. It didn't add up. There were plenty of girls with computers at school or at home who still weren't using them, and there was no research to substantiate a claim that girls were somehow inherently less skilled or interested in computer play. For Brenda, it came down to a software issue. Little girls didn't play computer games because the computer games were all for boys. The girls Brenda and her team interviewed from 1992 to 1996 didn't mince their feelings about the games they had played. They hated dying over and over. Violence stressed them out. And they weren't fans of the way games emphasized mastery, like defeating a difficult final boss or navigating fast-moving terrain without getting killed. Mastery for its own sake is not very good social currency for a girl, Brenda explains. They demand an experiential path. Instead of trying again and again to beat a level, a baddie, or the clock, the girls Brenda interviewed preferred to wander around, exploring a virtual world and learning the relationships between its characters and places. In Life on the Screen, published only a few years after Brenda began her research, the sociologist Sherry Turkle argued that while men generally see computers as a challenge, something to master and dominate, women see computers as tools, objects to be collaborated with. This soft mastery, she explained, requires a closeness, a connection to computers that's more like the relationship a musician has with her instrument. Intimate, dialogue-driven, relational. Just as musicians harmonize, Brenda found that her subjects played together, regardless of whether the games they played were designed for multiple players. She concluded that girls are naturally collaborative, and that their social experience of play is often as important as the objective of the game itself. Her subjects liked puzzles, discovery, and the immersive conversation with the machine that happened when storylines were strong enough to ensnare them, and they preferred to share their experiences with one another. At that age, I certainly did. After beating the CD-ROM game Myst in 1993, I remember jumping up and down on the rug with my best friends. Now this was R that could lead to some D. In 1996, Interval spun Brenda's research team into its own company, Purple Moon, which would produce games exclusively for young girls. It stood to reason that if boys were hogging the machines at the school computer lab to play games that girls didn't like, girls would later be disadvantaged in a workplace and a world where computer literacy is not only beneficial but necessary. Making games that girls did like seemed like the obvious solution. As one female game designer put it, "We cannot expect women to excel in technology tomorrow if we don't encourage girls to have fun with technology today." It was a smart business move, too. Girls represented a huge, untapped market, and the prevailing wisdom was that anyone who made a computer game that really appealed to them could conceivably double the games industry. This thinking was likely influenced by the unexpected success that year of Barbie Fashion Designer, a Mattel CD-ROM game that allowed its players to dress a virtual Barbie. The first best-selling girl game, it sold 600,000 units in 1996, far outselling first-person shooters like Doom and Quake, and surprising just about everyone in the games industry. Barbie Fashion Designer illuminated a market for girl games, and it bridged a gap between girls' real world and computer play. Barbie's digital ensembles could be printed, cut, and glued to fit a real Barbie. In terms of game mechanics, however, it hardly pushed the envelope. The idea of dressing a character wasn't even new. Boy games offered dress-up too, in the form of customizing an avatar, and that's usually before the actual adventure begins. This is emblematic of how the industry approached girl games before Purple Moon. Designers would often package reskinned, easier versions of established game mechanics. Barbie fashion designer's predecessor, a 1991 Barbie game for Super Nintendo, had done much the same thing, replacing coins with perfume bottles and monsters with beach balls. It was a boy game in a dress, what Brenda disdainfully calls the computer game equivalent of pink Legos. Purple Moon took a different approach. Rather than softening the edges around boy games, Brenda's company doubled down on complex characters and story building. I mean, it's not only that the characters are lame in most boys' games, she explained. It's that they're so lame you can't even make up an interesting story about them. Purple Moon produced two series of story games about an eighth grade girl, Rocket Movado, and her circle of friends at Whispering Pines Junior High. The Rocket games have no levels or repetitive trials, no clocks or leaderboards. They can't even be won. Brenda compares them to an emotional rehearsal space. In Rocket's new school, Rocket faces situations familiar to any teen or preteen girl. She has to make friends, navigate tricky social situations, and decide what kind of person she is. Will she invite nerdy Mavis to her party? Will she read another girl's private diary? Will she try to fit in with the popular kids, a clique called the Ones? Or will she speak her mind when she sees somebody being bullied? These questions are answered at branching points. Walking into homeroom on the first day of school, Rocket must decide who she will be. The choice is made inside her head, where three different versions of Rocket share a snippet of their inner dialogue. Each represents a path in the story. The terrified Rocket branches the game into a different storyline from the can-do Rocket, who ends up bickering with an alpha girl over a coveted back row seat. It's a hypertext, choose-your-own-adventure for social development. A first day of school you can do over and over again. One avid Purple Moon gamer, who played Rocket during her formative years, remembers how the games influenced her own development. I can definitely remember times when, instead of being quick to respond to someone, I thought about my words and what possible repercussions would be for each option I had, she explains. They truly helped teach me how to socialize and how to get along with people. These social lessons weren't only learned in Whispering Pines. Purple Moon's website, an early social network, extended the world of the Rocket games online, allowing girl gamers to learn more about their favorite characters and meet their fellow real-life players. Although Interval's founder, when first shown a prototype, asked only, "Can you do this for boys?" the Purple Moon website became a girl universe, what we'd now call a fandom. Girls submitted articles to the Whispering Pines school newspaper, inventing their own stories surrounding the plot lines they knew well, hung out in the Rocket forums, and exchanged virtual treasures relating to the game world. And unlike the greater web, the Purple Moon site was safe because girls registered their accounts through their parents and the site had a built-in panic button. "Simple," Brenda explains with characteristic brio. "Some shit's going on, you push the panic button. You get a screen capture. Everything goes to us. We see who was an asshole, we call their parents, we give them a warning." The Purple Moon website was arguably as influential as its games. In 1997, it was outdoing Disney's website in both hits and dwell time, and it had formed the cornerstone of many young girls' online world. Purple Moon published a companion series to Rocket's junior high adventures, Secret Paths. Where the Rocket games emphasized social skills, the Secret Paths games were friendship adventures, and unlike the high-stakes environment of middle school, were soothing and private. Secret Paths in the Woods, for example, begins in a treehouse. Depending on user preference, outside the window is an impressionistic mountain, a babbling stream ringed with flowers, or an ochre vista dotted with wild horses. In the room is a friendship box full of girls who need help. If you press your heart to one, she will reveal her secrets. Miko fears that other girls won't like her because she's too smart. Dana is really bummed that her team lost the state soccer championship. Whitney has problems with her stepmother. The objective of Secret Paths in the Forest is to help each girl by traveling down her path, weaving through whispering branches and glowing sunsets. Along the way, puzzles reward players with gemstones, representing different strengths the girl might need to overcome her problems. They become a gift, a necklace of amulets, shimmering with the promise of self-reliance. Secret Paths in the Forest, and later Secret Paths to the Sea, satisfied different emotional needs than Rocket's new school. They were quiet, slow, meditative games. They taught girls how to find emotional resources within themselves and how to observe and respond to others' unarticulated needs, in the words of one critic. They were meant to be played alone. And while the Rocket Games' emotional navigation gave girls a chance to try out social behaviors without embarrassing themselves, the accompanying series helped them to understand core values of empathy, kindness, and solidarity among girls to anchor them through the changes ahead. The shy young kids of Secret Paths become the self-assured preteens of Rocket, and there's no right way for them to do it. There are more generous paths, but Purple Moon's games reflected real life. Kids could play Rocket as sugar sweet, but sometimes a bad decision leads Rocket to a good place, like hiding out in the music room, where the cutest boy in school, Ruben, serenades her on the piano. This is what got Brenda in trouble. Purple Moon released 6 Rocket games. The first two broke the top 100 best-selling games the year they were released, beating industry titans like John Madden Football. Like the Women's Web, they represented a sea change in the gender dynamics of computer use. By the time Purple Moon established itself, so-called girl games were everywhere. Mattel, riding the success of Barbie fashion designer, released several more Barbie interactive titles, an ocean adventure, a game for designing and printing party invitations, and Barbie Magic Hairstyler, which requires little explanation. While Sega competed with Cosmo Virtual Makeover, and the Learning Company produced an American Girl series. The game designer Teresa Duncan found success with the dreamy alt-rock story games Chop Suey, Zero Zero, and Smarty. Her Interactive, an offshoot of American Laser Games, produced another high school adventure, Mackenzie & Co., which was like a Rocket game with live-action cutscenes, and a popular series of Nancy Drew games. This critical mass had an amplifying effect. The more studios jumped into girl games, the larger the shelf grew in the store. To kids, that real estate is a whole world. The Purple Moon gamer I spoke with, who was in elementary school during the upwelling, told me she just assumed, as a child, that the computer aisles had always been full of games for girls. The girl games movement coincided with an uptick in female-fronted businesses throughout the 1990s. Like Purple Moon, several of the major girl game studios were woman-owned and largely woman-staffed, paralleling a larger national trend for entrepreneurial feminism. This made it a hot topic in its day. Popular media found it fascinating. Nightline ran a special on girl gaming, and Time magazine, in a profile of Purple Moon, joked about girls needing a ROM of their own. It provoked even more chatter in game industry and academic circles, and several scholarly anthologies have been published on the subject. The excitement was largely based on the assumption that girl games would create a virtuous cycle, where girls playing computer games would lead to women writing game software, and hence more girl-friendly game experiences and even more girl gamers. But by 2000, the girl game movement was effectively over, with its most recognizable studios, Purple Moon among them, dead and buried. After Barbie Fashion Designer, no girl game studio managed to produce a blockbuster title. Industry observers eventually wrote the game off as a fluke, crediting its sales to Mattel's brand recognition. The typical American girl at the time owned, on average, 9 Barbies. But many critics argued that the fundamental thinking behind girl games was flawed, and that designing games explicitly for girls actually undermined them by forcing them into pink and purple fishbowls. Instead of separating kids by gender, critics argued, why not make games that all kids could enjoy? The first really successful computer games like Pong and Tetris had no explicit gender, and it wasn't until Atari put a pink bow on Pac-Man to create Ms. Pac-Man in 1980 that the issue was even raised. Brenda's research led her to believe that only boys enjoyed shooters and adventure games. But many girls, then and now, love blasting aliens and annihilating bosses with sprays of machine gun fire. As one self-professed game girl wrote in the late 1990s, what Purple Moon and other girly games companies have to understand is that although there is a market for games like Barbie Fashion Designer, there is just as big a market for girls who like to do the same things boys do. Purple Moon found itself embroiled in a much larger cultural conversation about the influence of games on kids' lives, and its girl-forward approach was read as essentialism. In an influential editorial, the feminist critic Rebecca Eisenberg questioned the research that spawned Purple Moon, arguing that the Rocket Games, with their focus on popularity and fashion, only reinforce the very same stereotypes they purport to combat. While Brenda Laurel designed Whispering Pines Junior High to mirror the social realities of the girls she'd interviewed, Purple Moon's critics lambasted the company for presenting too narrow a view of girlhood and for emphasizing the same patterns of exclusion and affiliation feminists work so hard to deconstruct. Didn't girls deserve better than a cartoon version of a world they already knew? When I asked Brenda about this, she's more pragmatic. She was making an intervention at the level of popular culture, and that required a certain broad appeal. You can't get buy-in from somebody when they don't recognize the character they're playing, she says. In 1999, Interval pulled the plug on Purple Moon. The company did not have a graceful end. Paul Allen took us into Chapter 7, Brenda says, and we had to talk him out of that and get back into Chapter 11 so we could sell the damn thing to Mattel at a bargain basement price and make everybody's paycheck. It was just hideous how it came out. Brenda was forced to shut down the Purple Moon website, where girls from all over the world had formed intense friendships, and to fire most of her staff, 80% of whom were women, the inverse of most Silicon Valley workplaces, in a day. At a game developers conference in San Jose that year, she blamed Purple Moon's failure on a tech marketplace that valued short-term gains over long-term progress, and which fetishized incorporeal web businesses over those actually selling physical, warehoused goods. I promise to talk to you about some approaches to research and design that will help us grow both our audiences and our ideas, she told the crowd, according to the New York Times. But since Purple Moon did not make it to the big IPO or a lavish acquisition that made everybody rich, it would be understandable for you to conclude the methods I'm advocating for don't necessarily work. She later published a book titled Utopian Entrepreneur. Barbie bought Rocket on a shopping spree. In 1999, when Mattel acquired Purple Moon, it also picked up The Learning Company, which produced the Carmen Sandiego games, and Pleasant Company, known for its American Girl dolls and games, before shutting down their games group entirely, effectively kneecapping the girl games movement. Mattel was trying to protect their Barbie franchise, Brenda says. They bought everybody and drove a stake through their hearts. But by the late 1990s, the most recognizable female figure in video games wasn't Rocket or even Barbie. It was the buxom Tomb Raider, Lara Croft, with a hyper-sexualized body and skin-tight ensemble that earned her legions of male fans. After Purple Moon folded, Brenda held a wake at her house. Former employees and friends of the company gathered around a toy Rocket figurine, laid to rest in a miniature plastic locker on Brenda's antique dining room table, flanked by black candles, bouquets of purple irises, and a seriously depleted bottle of Irish whiskey. Brenda poured herself a shot and gave a eulogy to the little red-haired girl on which she'd staked the future of games. "We're always trying to heal something," she said. "Lousy childhoods, raw deals, crappy self-esteem. We were trying to heal something when we made her." Brenda has 3 daughters, and it's clear her mission was personal. They were preteens when Purple Moon shipped its first game, and barely a few years older when the company was shut down. Like any passage through the final stage of childhood, it wasn't long enough. To console their mother, the girls strung the rocket figurine on a length of pink yarn and dangled her from the second floor landing like an angel. Before I leave her house, Brenda runs into her office and plucks something from an altar in the corner. A milky blue bead shaped like a moon. It's one of the original Secret Paths gems, sold by Purple Moon in packs of 6 in little purple velvet baggies for girls to collect and trade. She hands it to me triumphantly. On the back is inscribed a single word, maturity. It's presumably the trait I need to complete the necklace of strength that will help me through the next phase of my life. It seems incongruous for a plastic toy to tell anyone to grow up. But I look at Brenda, at the altar of sacred objects at her side, and I realize it's not telling me to grow up. It's trying to teach me how. The gem comes home with me, down the long path through the forest. Epilogue. The Cyber Feminists. In the summer of 1992, a billboard popped up overnight on the side of an art gallery in Sydney, Australia. 18 feet long, it featured a strange assortment of images, spherical fragments of DNA, vaginal wedges of color, and a pair of mirrored women with unicorn horns, flexing their muscles and emerging from seashells. In the middle was a blob of text, rendered convex as a bead of water. "We are the virus of a new world disorder," it read, "disrupting the symbolic from within. Saboteurs of Big Daddy mainframe. The clitoris is a direct line to the Matrix." Not a moment too soon, the cyberfeminists had arrived. The billboard, an artwork called A Cyberfeminist Manifesto for the 21st Century, was produced by a 4-woman art collective from Adelaide. Josephine Stars, Julianne Pierce, Francesca de Rimini, and Virginia Barrett, known together as VNS Matrix. Their blasphemous text was written in one night a few years previous as a free association about new representations of women, gender, and sexuality in technospace, both primordial, ancient, and futuristic, fantastic, and active, as Barrett explained to me several years ago. In 1991, VNS Matrix wheat-pasted their manifesto onto city walls and faxed it to tech magazines and feminist artists around the world, proclaiming the dawn of a new age. A century and a half after Ada Lovelace first scratched a computer program onto paper, it was time for women to become the virus, the signal, and the pulse of the network. When the manifesto took billboard form, a student from Britain photographed it and brought the photo home to her professor, the cultural theorist Sadie Plant, who was designing a curriculum in a similar spirit. In her 1997 book, Zeros and Ones, Plant explains that when VNS Matrix wrote, "The clitoris is a direct line to the Matrix," they meant both the womb, Matrix is Latin, and the abstract networks of communication increasingly assembling themselves in the world around them. It was an evocative vision of women's bodily connection to networked computing, a connection that emerged before the technology itself, beginning with Ada Lovelace and the countless uncounted female computers, a lineage Plant traces in her book, much as I have in mine. Sadie Plant and VNS Matrix are considered the matriarchs of cyberfeminism, a wild, breathlessly utopian, very brief art movement that flourished in the mid-1990s as the web began to reshape the world. Cyberfeminism conjures, in many ways, the countercultural techno-utopian feeling of early internet culture, and inherits the spirit of those West Coast cyber hippies who believed that computer-mediated communication would create a free civilization of the mind. The motley crew of artists, coders, game designers, and writers who pronounced themselves cyberfeminists joyfully subverted what VNS Matrix called Big Daddy Mainframe, the patriarchy hard-coded to the technological underpinnings of the world, a backbone built by men. The technological landscape was very dry, Cartesian, reverent, Barrett says. It was uncritical and overwhelmingly male-dominated. It was a masculinist space, coded as such, and the gatekeepers of the code maintained control of the productions of technology. After so many generations of women's technological accomplishments being buried by time, indifference, and the shifting protocols of the network itself, the cyberfeminists were hungry to claim their place in the technological now, and loudly. Cyberfeminist thinkers and artists understood the internet as an unprecedented platform for free thought and expression, like a dormant virus in the mainframe. The prefix cyber summoned it. Ubiquitous at the time, with cyberculture, cyberdelics, cybersex, cyberpunk, and cyberslacker too, of course. Cyber evoked the collective hallucination of digital space and the placeless, incorporeal world of electronic networks. The cyber feminists were fascinated by the idea of online space without geography, without predefined conventions, and believed a new kind of feminism might set sail there, afloat and untethered on an ocean of fiber and bits. The internet was far less regulated, far less commodified, VNS Matrix's Francesca de Rimini says. More of a mall and a maw than a mall. There seem to be endless possibilities. To the many women coming online in the early 1990s, cyberfeminism looked, for all the world, like the next big wave of feminism. If the previous generation had thought globally but acted locally, holding their consciousness-raising sessions in each other's living rooms, then the internet could collapse the difference, creating a global living room where pixels and code did the work of pickets and fists. Indeed, the first generation of feminists to the web understood that access was an equality issue, and they learned to translate the organizing and campaigning experience of second-wave feminism to the new medium. Some of their earliest efforts on the web include informational websites for victims of abuse, feminist forums, and an animated GIF candlelight vigil for domestic violence. As the population becomes widely familiar with the new communications technologies, wrote Scarlett Pollock and Joe Sutton, editors of the Canadian feminist magazine Women's Space, the challenge to feminists is whether we'll be online and ready to greet them. Cyberfeminist artists made revolutionary CD-ROMs, created web-based multimedia artworks, and built virtual worlds, taking many forms as they swam through the network seeking pleasure and knowledge. They wrote howling agitprop, like the Cyberfeminist Manifesto for the 21st century. They formed coalitions, mailing lists, and discussion groups, like the Old Boys Network, a group that proclaimed cyberfeminism to be, above all, a question of survival and power and fun. VNS Matrix even made a video game, All New Gen, in which the player must hack into the databanks of Big Daddy Mainframe, the Oedipal embodiment of the techno-industrial complex, and slime him and his cohort, Circuit Boy, Street Fighter, and other total dicks, into oblivion, sowing the seeds of the new world disorder and ending the rule of phallic power on Earth. Like the network itself, the movement was expansive and multifarious. Cyberfeminism only exists in the plural, pronounced the Swiss art critic Yvonne Folkart in 1999. Even at the height of the word's usage, it could never be trusted to mean any single specific approach to feminism at the dawn of the web revolution. Instead, The word cyberfeminism granted currency to an array of positions, some of which were mutually exclusive. At the first Cyberfeminist International, a 1997 gathering in Kassel, Germany, attendees settled against defining the term, instead collectively authoring 100 antitheses, a laundry list of things cyberfeminism was not. That list includes the following. Not for sale. Not postmodern. Not a fashion statement. Not a picnic. Not a media hoax. Not nice. Not Lacanian. Not science fiction. And my personal favorite, not about boring toys for boring boys. Privately, however, the cyberfeminists worried that what was being hailed as the virtual techno-paradise of the new millennium, as the social scientist Renate Klein wrote in 1999, might eventually become as woman-hating as much of real life at the end of the 20th century. To cut off that eventuality, they hoped to move quickly, establishing an online presence colorful, confident, and vivid enough to create a permanent association between women and technological culture, which is their birthright. But being a woman online today comes with the same anxieties that have always followed women and minorities, and fears of being silenced, excluded, and bullied remain as palpably real in the digital realm as they are IRL. Our dense net of connective technologies and the increasing facility by which we are surveilled within them has led to new forms of violence. Doxing, cyberstalking, trolling, revenge porn. And anonymity, which the cyberfeminists, along with many early cyberculture thinkers, championed as a method for transcending gender and difference, enables violently misogynistic language all over the web. In YouTube comments, on forums, on Reddit and 4chan, and in the inboxes and at replies of women with public opinions. The incorporeal newness that so intoxicated the earliest women online has morphed. It has become what the games critic Catherine Cross aptly calls a Mobius strip of reality and unreality, in which internet culture becomes real when it is convenient and unreal when it is not. Real enough to hurt people in, unreal enough to justify doing so. As a movement, cyberfeminism disappeared with the popping of the dot-com bubble. We did what we had to do at the time, Barrett explains. Our job, as female-identified people and as feminists, was to overthrow the gatekeepers in order to access a powerful new technology which had huge implications for domination and control by the patriarchy and by capitalist systems. As the web commercialized, it became clear that the internet was not going to liberate anyone from sexism, or for that matter from divisions of class, race, ability, and age. Instead, it often perpetuated the same patterns and dynamics of the meat space world. Capitalist systems have won. The personal brand is king. And as ongoing battles for net neutrality have revealed, the gatekeepers still hold tightly to the keys. It's not that the cyberfeminists, or any of their predecessors, have failed. It's that as digital and real life edge into near complete overlap, the digital world inherits the problems of the real. Trace a pen across the Mobius strip and it leads you right back to where you started. In this continuous surface, it's harder and harder to draw distinctions. The computers are smaller now, and they come with us to bed. They measure our breathing as we sleep. They listen and track us as we navigate the world. Social networks have built empires by selling us what we already want, and our opinions are formed in bubbles, in a continuous loop of algorithmic feedback. For better or worse, we have become the network, bodies and all. But that can be a good thing, too. Because as we map our society ever more closely to the screen, we create an increasingly powerful tool for changing it. Lies online can become truth if they are propagated widely enough. And social media has remade the way we travel, eat, and start revolutions. Every decision made in the design of our most intimate technologies affects our lives, our cities, our social structures, and our collective experience of what is right, real, and true. When we create technologies, we don't just mirror the world. We actually make it. And we can remake it, so long as we understand the awesome nature of the responsibility. The more diversity there is at the table, the more interesting the result on screen, the more human. As Stacey Horn would say, bite me, the better. There's no right kind of engineer, no special plane of thought that must be reached to make a worthwhile contribution. There's no right education, no right career path. Sometimes there isn't even a plan. The internet is made of people, as it was made for people, and it does what we tell it to do. We can remake the world. The first step is to see it clearly, seeing who was really there at the most pivotal points in our technological history, without taking for granted the prevailing myths of garages and riches, of alpha nerds and brogrammers. The second step is to learn all the strategies of triumph and survival we can from our forebears, and I hope this book has unearthed a few. Ada Lovelace's refusal of propriety, Grace Hopper's forward-thinking tenacity, and the support the women of Resource One gave one another. Jake Feindler's clarity of vision in the chaos of a changing network. A draft of Jamie Levy's punk rock spirit for courage, and a healthy helping of BNS Matrix's bodily self-assurance that the internet is our place, wild and weird and mind-bending, as it has always been. The final step is the hardest. We get to work. Acknowledgements. Writing a book is the ultimate life hack. I know of no better way to meet your heroes. I am deeply indebted to the people who opened up their calendars, their hard drives, and their memories for me. Not everyone made it into the final version of this book, but you have all had an immeasurable influence on my thinking. Pat Wilcox, Pamela Hart English, Sherry Reason, Joan Lefkowitz, Maya Schoen, Chris Macy, Lee Felsenstein, Elizabeth Jake Feindler, Mary Stahl, Radia Perlman, Eliza Sherman, Ellen Pack, Nancy Rhine, Naomi Pierce, Stacey Horn, Marisa Bowe, Jamie Levy, Howard Middlemark, Dame Wendy Hall, Annette Wagner, Kathy Marshall, Judy Malloy, Karen Catlin, Nicole Yankelevich, Gina Garubo, Lori Kretschmar, Marlene McDaniel, Naomi Clark, Brenda Laurel, Adrian Unique, Amy Bruckman, Antoinette Lafarge, Cynthia Duval, Helen Varley Jameson, Judy Judge Anderson, Julie Burke, Lisa Bernays, Lynn Finch, Pavel Curtis, Jim Bumgardner, and Yib. I've been an awed and grateful witness, but this is only the beginning. There are more fascinating stories about women in technology than I could ever have fit in these pages, and I sincerely hope to read many, many more books on the subject in the years to come. Thanks are due also to those who helped along the way. To Robert Kett and Martina Heidfogel at SF MoMA, who helped me to consult the CD-ROM archive of Word magazine in the museum's permanent collection. Wendy Cover at the Internet Hall of Fame, who connected me with early networking pioneers. Sydney Gulbronson Olson at the Computer History Museum, who handled my queries about community memory. And the saintly people of the Internet Archive, without whose Wayback Machine the dot-com era chapters would have been impossible to write. Give them all your money. I'm not a trained historian, and I am deeply appreciative of the work done by the scholars of computing history cited throughout this book, particularly in the early chapters. They're doing world-changing work, in many cases writing egregious exclusions. When the document overwhelmed me, I turned to the best writers I know. Brian Merchant shared war stories, software strategies, and essential insights on early chapters and drafts. Karina Laughlin was always deft, with an email full of research leads, PDFs, and feedback. Catherine Burrell Jr. was an invaluable sounding board.